For an even better way to listen to Football Weekly at home, at work or on the go, head to soundcloud.com/Guardian Football Weekly or download the SoundCloud app for Android and iPhone.
Football Weekly Extra.
Football Weekly Extra today. Hey, hun, it's the all-German Champions League final. Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich. Bosh, in a very real sense. Pod asks, will Jupp's troops give Borussia das Boot? Or will it be no guts and no glory for Klopp's squad? And we salute the real winner of Saturday's final, Raphael Honigstein, as he continues his attempt to visit all 92 British media outlets in the build-up. Elsewhere, there's the game the Champions League is a mere aperitif for the Championship playoff final. Millions set to shower on one lucky outfit. Will it be plucky Ian Holloway's poo-powered Crystal Palace or little Gianfranco Zola's borrowed Watford? All of that plus Tony Pulis, where's my 24-page supplement? Coppa Italia, highs and lows, a bit of Sid and Post in Football Weekly Extra. OK then, off we toddle with Greg Bukowski.
Hi James.
Hey, Barry Glendening.
Hello.
Hello, and people's favourite, Raphael Honigstein.
Hello, James.
Thanks for joining us, Rafa. You're just,
oh, pleasure.
You're just hot-footed in from Ronnie Irani and Alan Brazil's breakfast.
Don't like to.
Do you know,
drop names.
No, but it was a historic... Was it not Ronnie Irani's last ever breakfast show today?
I've been led to believe it was, but I completely forgot about it and didn't say anything to him.
All right.
Why is it his last one?
I don't know.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Don't
I'm
know.
Not his mother. But did you have a nice
time? I saw in the green room...
Oh, yeah.
You know about this technical term... Mm. I saw Keezy and Gray.
And Grazy,
yeah.
Cool.
And loads of banter.
Did you bant?
I didn't,
Jonathan Wilson's been on their show.
No, there was great banter because someone was knocking on the door.
Right.
And it was clearly locked, but they kept screaming, it's open, for that only for that guy to keep pushing. And they were cracking up. You know, it's like the best joke you've ever heard.
Right.
Oh, he's pushing and the door's closed.
Yeah. That is funny, but not as funny as your story about the airport.
Well.
Yeah. Anyway, super. Tell you what, there's so much to talk about today, if you squint. there's that big Champions League final.
But by the time this pod goes out, the game's over, right?
No. Go on, there's some cleverness going on here. What are we talking about?
Lyon?
Lyon?
Aren't we talking about Lyon Wolfsburg?
Who are they playing in? Is that a women's Champions League final? Is it?
Oh, it's tonight. Stamford Bridge tonight, isn't it? Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
No,
you've ruined it now.
Oh, Rafa. Too clever. Too clever. We can talk about that one if you want. No, all right. Borussia Bayern. How many stations have you been on so far, Rafa? You're all talked out, aren't you? We don't even need to ask you questions. You just do your spiel and then go home.
I should really record this and just press play.
What's the best question you've been asked so far about the Champions League final?
This one.
good. You know, One Nation finals, they're often a bit drab, aren't they? I mean, you know, the classic Milan Juventus from 2003.
But they've all been a bit. Sense.
I mean, Real Madrid Valencia, that wasn't great.
It was just too one sided, wasn't it?
I suppose Man U Chelsea wasn't bad.
No, I think it was actually a good final.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Is this going to be a great ending?
Yeah.
Some people say.
Absolutely.
This is going to be a good one.
Is it going to be good, Barry?
Yes, it's going to be brilliant.
What's going to happen?
I am like a dog with two tails, just looking forward to this. Often, you know, you anticipate a game and you really look forward to it, and then it ends up not being as good as you'd hope. But I really think this is going to be a fantastic match.
Right.
Two brilliant teams,
right.
Attacking teams.
Why does your voice not sound like it's going to be that good?
Barry. that's his excitement.
When you've got a sort of monotonous Irish Midlands drawl, you've been cursed with that, it's very hard to sound excited about anything.
Mm.
My fear for the neutrals,
yeah.
As it were, is that it might actually be a bit more one-sided than people think, especially if Bayern score early. I think if Bayern score the first goal, there's a bigger chance of the game maybe finishing sort of 3-1, 4-1 than a narrow comeback from Dortmund. But the absolute key in this game is really that first goal, I think. If Dortmund score first, everything is perfectly set up for them. Bayern, as strong as they are mentally this season, will have doubt creeping in at that point and think, you know, here we are again, chasing a lead, or, you know, this is another disappointment. But I think Bayern, if they score first, they might run away with it.
Hasn't Klopp spoken this season about trying to make his team not press as hard as they used to, and so they don't kind of wear themselves out for when they do get possession. Do you not think you might, just for this game, it's a one-off, just say, just go out there, press them as hard as you can and try and get the first goal and then see how it goes from there?
It's not really about pressing less hard, it's where they press. They press deeper now. They press at the halfway line. Before that, the season before, they press just as they did in Bundesliga, all the way up to the first ball out on the fullbacks or in the centre backs, and they found that in the Champions League, even against teams like Olympiacos, they couldn't do it because they were technically too good. They played around them, and then the defenders found themselves 1v1 all the time. And the thing with Bayern is that they have learned over the last 2 years now to deal with that pressing, and they are much better at keeping the ball even when they're pressed, and they've also added an element of pressing themselves. So I think the psychology has changed a little bit. They used to be the bogey team. They used to be the team that Bayern couldn't beat. This season, there were 2-1-1 draws in the league and a 1-0 win by Bayern in the cup. But you just feel that it's no longer sort of this, oh no, it's Dortmund, you know, we don't know what to do against them. It's just become another team that they've been able to adapt to. Bayern can adapt. Dortmund can only play the Dortmund style, which is 100%, regardless of where on the pitch they press. They will press very intensely. Bayern have this ability to mix it up a little bit, as you saw against Barcelona, where they played a counter-attacking game, basically. Ceded possession, which is not their game, but it didn't matter to them.
Surely pressing, schmessing, Rafa. Chelsea proved last season that the best thing to do with Bayern is just to sit back and let them wear themselves out and then hit them on the break.
Yes, although I would say that this Bayern team is much better.
Ah.
They have more...
Why is this one better?
Well, they have better players. They have no suspensions.
Right.
And they have a lot of interesting players that they can bring on from the bench if things don't work. Last year, they had absolutely nothing on the bench. This year, they have real quality. And also, the players individually play a lot better this year than he did last year. Robin looks in great shape.
That's
Ribéry looks in great shape. Müller is on an unbelievable run over the last few weeks. Mandzukic is an upgrade on Gomez. And you just go through the whole team, and Martinez is a fantastic player next to Schweinsteiger, closing down the midfield.
Mm.
They are a better side than they were last year. And last year, they weren't that bad either. So you see why... And certainly in Germany, Bayern are being seen as big favourites.
Right. I have a friend who hasn't watched as much Bayern as he should have in the course of this season, but when he has
watched them... Italian football, that friend?
Who doesn't, to be fair? But when he has watched them, he's often been impressed with Arjen Robben and the amount of work that Arjen Robben was doing. And he's noted the fact that commentators go, well, this is an unbelievable amount from Arjen Robben. He doesn't usually play like this. And he's just wondering if a lot of Bayern's success this year actually hinges on that Dutchman coming up with the goods and whether on the big night he might not do.
Well, Jupp Heynckes has said that it took him a long time to convince both Ribéry and Robben that they had to start doing their share of the defensive work, and they weren't buying this idea at all. But clearly he has convinced them, or forced them, to see the merit of doing their share of the defensive duties, and that is definitely a huge part of Bayern's success, I would argue.
Also, Dortmund's left-back Schmelz has been their weak link, hasn't he? And if there's one player I think Arjen Robben would fancy his chances against, I think it's against Schmelzer at the weekend as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, Schmelzer is good, but he's not quite at the same level as all the other 21 players, I think, on the pitch. And he is the obvious target for getting Robben up against him. And I mean, the way that Robben and Ribéry have been playing is really outstanding. But it's really just them doing what everyone else does, which is really learning the lessons of last year and using all that frustration and traumatic experience and saying the only way to get over this is by working even harder. And it's no secret. You saw it with Barcelona when they were at their very best. If you have very, very good players who are also working incredibly hard, that's a combination that's very, very powerful. And this year they've got it. And I can tell you that even off the record, the people at Bayern, they cannot believe just how hardworking and diligent and professional this team is, because, you know, they've seen a lot of good teams in the past, but they usually had characters who thought, you know, I'm very good, I don't have to train that much, or, you know, the night before the game, I can do whatever I want. This team is so focused, so intent on winning the Champions League and righting what they see as the wrong of last season, that it's tough to see past them.
All right. What about the atmosphere? I note you say that Dortmund supporter choreography has been nixed at Wembley because of draconian security measures. What sort of thing are we going to be missing out on? Or what sort of thing are we going to be seeing?
It's always a big secret what they do. So the Bayern supporters who are going ahead with the choreography haven't made their exact plans public. The one with the cup didn't work out that well last season so much, if you remember, where they waved the big cup around. Dortmund is a shame because...
Would it be the binoculars thing?
No, they wouldn't do that again. But it's a shame because after 15 years, you know, it's only their second Champions League final, and they'd really been planning something very spectacular and buying up loads of material already, and everyone was getting ready to start doing these things on Friday morning, 9 o'clock. And now it's been called off. They themselves called it off because UEFA or Wembley's regulations were such that they felt they couldn't actually do themselves justice and thought it's better not to do it than sort of something lame and half-hearted.
Right. I'm sure if they were raising a big MasterCard kind of banner, that'd be fine, wouldn't it?
Dressing in orange, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
It is a shame, but hopefully the teams are going to provide the real spectacle. Domtar wants to know, what difference, if any, winning the Champions League final would have on Dortmund's attempts to keep the majority of this fantastic squad together?
I don't think it's going to make much difference. The real problem that they faced in the past is wages. You know, a player like Robert Lewandowski, arguably the best footballing centre-forward in the world right now, is on 20 grand
a
week.
When you say footballing, what do you mean?
I mean that you probably have more prolific strikers and maybe more sort of irresistible box players, but his all-round game, I think, is second to none. He can hold up the ball, he can go deep, he can go wide, he plays fantastic passes, and he's good with his left, right, and in the air. So I think, you know, he's pretty complete package.
He can hold up the ball like a flat tire for Cinderella.
Yeah.
Right.
But he's only on £20,000 a week.
No way.
And that explains why he's very keen on making a move. And what Dortmund have done over the last 2 or 3 years is a lot of the money that has come in from their success, they've reinvested it into the squad. So they've kind of made invisible signings, getting everyone's wages up to keep them. And they're continuing to do that. It happens all the time. Mats Hummels signed a new deal not long ago. And that is the real battle. If they win now the Champions League, you know, you might as well turn around and say, oh, you know, this team has done everything they could do. Maybe it's a good time to go somewhere else for everyone, including Klopp. So I don't think that either way the outcome would make much of a difference. The real battle for them is to hold on to their players and to make some smart investments, which they always have done over the last few years when they have lost players like Kagawa, like Lucas Barrios, like Nuri Sahin, who's now coming.
I was going to say, to withstand, like to still keep their kind of performance levels high, even though they've lost those players, has been a feat in itself, hasn't it? To be in a Champions League final, having won the league twice.
Yeah, it is. Although, you know, they also finished 25 points adrift of Bayern in the league, which showed you that they haven't quite got the depth in the squad, the quality to challenge for both the Championship and the Champions League. That's where they need to get at. That's why they are still the underdogs. That's why they're still a club who are surprised themselves that they've made it this far, because they're almost sort of ahead of their own project, the way they've come from out of nowhere to Wembley in 3 years.
But as Jurgen Klopp revealed in his interview with Donald McRae, which...
Great interview.
Yeah, if anyone hasn't read it yet, it's worth digging out on the football website, that they spent their pre-season in Sweden making hats out of elk skulls.
Right.
Which is a good help. Götze obviously is out for the final. How is that going to affect Dortmund, apart from having a detrimental effect, presumably? How will they cover for his absence?
Yeah, there are two options, really. One would be to push up Ilkay Gundogan in the number 10 position and move Royce to the right. That's something that they're debating, but I think the much more likely scenario is Royce moving into Götze's position in the number 10 and Kevin Grosskreutz, who's a utility player, not as technical, not as attacking minded, coming in on the right, which will definitely help when it comes to fighting against Bayern's strong left side with Alaba and Ribéry, but it'll hurt them as far as breaking and going forward is concerned, because the understanding that Götze and Royce in particular had with Lewandowski ahead of them was quite fantastic.
If he comes in on the right, then where would Błażejkowski go? Is he not usually their right winger?
Yeah, I thought he'd be on the right mid ahead of Piszczek, wouldn't he? Błażejkowski.
Yeah, I mean, the Błażejkowski and Grosskreutz couldn't play either side of a mid player. Kuba is mostly played on the right, but Grosskreutz is probably more comfortable on the right because he's also right-footed. So yeah, it could be either or. I mean, it doesn't really make a difference. The key thing would be Royce moving into the middle, which is a good move in itself, but then it takes away from that bit of creativity that they had with Mario Götze, because Götze had this great ability to change places with Royce, and sometimes also playing as a centre forward with Lewandowski dropping deep.
Right. In a conversation I had with Jonathan Wilson earlier this week, one of us pointed out that that Götze also provided a fundamental defensive role, certainly against Real Madrid, in terms of closing down Xavi Alonso, reducing his ability to spray the ball around and do all that controlling thing. And also the fact that Klopp has also previously resorted when facing Bayern to going five across the middle to not allow them that space on the wings.
What did Jonathan say to that theory?
He was scratching his head. But after I'd gone through it three times, I really had to move on.
I mean, it's not really anything different that they do against Bayern than other teams. They've shuffled things around when it comes to the exact positioning of, for example, Błażejkowski played a slightly different, more central role when they played away to City, which was arguably Dortmund's best performance, even though it was a 1-1 draw of the whole season. I think they're unable to change, which is a good thing, in the sense that their plan A is very, very strong and works good enough. But it's a bad thing, I think, when it comes to Bayern, who I feel have sussed them out a little bit. They know how to approach Dortmund, and they have the players as well as the tactics and the work ethic this year to deal with them. And that 1-1 draw a couple of weeks ago at Dortmund, Bayern played with essentially a reserve team. Dortmund played with a pretty decent side. Bayern had Rafinha sent off with half an hour to go, and still they came away with a 1-1 draw at Westfalenstadion, and it felt a little bit like another, almost like a victory for Bayern. So I think tactically Bayern have more options, and they know how to treat this Dortmund team now.
Is it going to be a rough final?
It could be a little bit rough, although I think the players be very, very careful, because nobody wants to get sent off in a Champions League final. I don't think it's going to be any really silly, stupid fouls designed to hurt anyone, because the downside is bigger than the benefit you get. Right, and of course, nobody wants to foul future teammate Lewandowski, you know.
Mm-hmm. And surely Pep Guardiola is going to be supporting Dortmund, isn't he? He doesn't want the prospect of going in to take over the team who've just won the treble. Because they play in the German Cup final, don't they, against Stuttgart?
They do, yeah. I don't know. What does he like? Does he want to play in the
you want to be able to improve on something, don't you?
Yeah, but does he want to play in the Super Cup against Jose Mourinho in Prague at the end of August? Or does he want to pick up a team who've lost their third final in 4 years and will be seen as a basket case by a lot of people?
No.
I don't know. I think as a coach, it's much easier to come to a team who are winning things rather than not winning things. I think there's two schools of thoughts here. One saying, if Bayern win, you know, what can Guardiola really do? Mm. He's on a hiding to nothing. He can only lose. I'd like to think that when you win, it's actually a very good situation, a very good spot to make big changes, because history has shown, certainly in Germany, with teams who've won the Champions League and then everything continues the same way with the same manager, the same players, they find it very, very difficult to motivate themselves next year. And I think with him coming in and making perhaps one or two changes and certainly one or two signings and keeping things fresh, it's a good thing in either case, because if they don't win, they will hope that he will push him over the line next time with the stuff that he brings to the table. And if they do win, they hope that he's the right man to prolong that success. So I think it's a win to either way.
It's also a win either way for Götze, who turns up at the final in his suit, and he can bring a Bayern kit and a Borussia Dortmund kit and do a John Terry and join in the celebrations of whoever wins.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Is this, they face each other four times this season already, with two draws in the league, well, and the Super Cup, the 2-1 victory for Bayern at the start. I'm sorry if I'm right, Rafa, deal with it. but is this the biggest German game of all time? Come on, Bayern against Borussia in the Champions League final. Is it?
You could make an argument, if you wanted to be pedantic, and I hate to be.
Oh, God,
The 74 World Cup game between West Germany and East Germany
was
potentially bigger. Yeah. But as far as, you know, club football is concerned, of course,
this is huge, isn't it? Germany want to win?
That's a very easy to answer. They all want Dortmund to win.
Right.
There was actually a poll a couple of days ago, 21% want Bayern to win. Almost everyone else, with a few people who can't decide or can't be bothered,
want
Dortmund to win.
It's still a bunch of socialists against a bunch of capitalists, isn't it, this one? Like the 74 one.
I mean, that's the Jurgen Klopp take on things.
He'd like to think
We are not a company. They're also the only publicly traded Bundesliga team who went IPO in 2000 and then spent all the 150 million euros that they made from the share offering on players and then bankrupted themselves within 3 years. So, don't know how socialist that is.
Is it in his contract that he's got to look like a shambling English literature teacher then or something?
I think he looks more like a German geography teacher.
German geography teacher, shambling English literature teacher, it's all the same.
Yeah, he has that style. And it's interesting because only this week, I think, in the interview in The Guardian, he was talking about the fact that Hamburg came to see him and interviewed him for a job. And then they went away saying, this guy wears... wears jeans with holes and look at his stubble. Not really impressed. And they hired, I think, Martin Jol and a few other managers since. And look what they missed out on.
Yeah, don't think to be hiring too many people from this podcast then if they're against stubble and jeans with holes.
That's true. We're all quite stubbly in here, listeners. Well, there you go then. That is the Champions League final on Saturday. Rafa, you think it's a done deal, clearly. You don't want to say, but you obviously think it's a done deal.
And the thing is, I don't want to riff on his pain.
I have form on
Rafa's
predicting
Champions League final predictions are not great. Would this be your fourth incorrect one in a row? Not that
I only remember the 3-0 from United against Barcelona in 2009, which was the right prediction. It's just that the game didn't plan out that way because Ferguson got it so wrong.
Barry, actually, there was somebody who was tweeting asking what your strangest bet this season has been, but where does your money lie on this one? Have you ventured something?
I haven't had a bet. I hope Borussia Dortmund win, and I have a sneaking feeling they might.
Right. Greg, you got any thoughts?
I want Dortmund to win as well, but I reckon it'll be 1-1 and then Bayern Munich will probably nick it in extra time. 2-1 Bayern Munich in extra time.
Right.
It's like Klopp has actually said, what was his quote? If we win, we will not be the best team in the world. We will have beaten the best team in the world. Which I thought was
nice
little soundbite.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think everyone, apart from obviously Bayern Munich fans, wants Dortmund to win.
Right.
Just the same way they wanted plucky little Wigan to win the FA Cup final, and we saw what happened there.
Yeah. Is Klopp always this fantastic?
He is, although he has a real nasty side as well. He's been shoving referees and screaming in their faces and being quite embarrassed himself of his own antics and fined by the German FA. And sometimes when they lose, his post-match interviews make for uncomfortable viewing.
Right.
Because he gets very, very aggressive. And you can see that there is, I wouldn't say a dark side, but a very competitive side to his character as well. But he's always good, good quotes, always good box office, regardless of the outcome. So that's, in that sense, he's great.
Yeah. All right. Wow. Certainly looking forward to that game. Let's have a little musical interlude, and then we're back with a really big Wembley match this
Scorpions
weekend.
Scorpions or musical interlude.
Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it?
Or
should we just
Hasselhoff
provide our own? Right, after Monday's sing-along went down so well, there you go. Now, after the break, the biggest game at Wembley this weekend. Okay, Championship playoff final, and you can make a case based on figures that this is the biggest game in football. People keep doing that, and the numbers have got even bigger this time around, have they not?
They have, yeah. I believe next season you could earn more than 60 million, which is what United earn from TV money this season, even if you finish, you know, in the bottom half of the table or something. So, yeah, it's huge for Palace and Watford, you know, in monetary terms.
Absolutely. Well, bizarrely, it sees Watford and Palace finish their season with the very game that they started with, because they began with a 3-2 Watford win at Crystal Palace, opening day of the Championship season. Palace have reached more Championship playoff finals than any other team. They've won three of the four. This is the fifth. But the team finishing third in the regular season, that's Watford, have won more playoff finals than any other finishing position.
Do you know who the least successful team in playoff history is?
I'm going to guess. Is it Preston?
It is Preston. Yeah. Preston have been involved in eight playoffs and never been promoted.
Wow. Anyway, Watford finished third. Explain, Greg. What's going to happen here? They've got the momentum, haven't they, Watford, off that extraordinary finish against Leicester?
Yeah, you could say that, but I think Palace would talk about momentum. I mean, they beat their, you know, the most fierce rivals in their own backyard.
But they lost top scorer Glenn Murray.
They did, but they didn't need him to beat Brighton in that match. He was just sat on the bench with his crutches having a drink, wasn't he? So I think it could go either way. I mean, the results this season, I think they drew 2-2 when they last met in the league. It was a very close game. Yeah. You'd probably say Watford perhaps a slight favourites, but I wouldn't. You can't write Palace off. And Zaha was fantastic. I mean, he was very sloppy in the first half against Brighton, and then he got a grip of the game in the second half, and he looked, you know, like he should be playing for Man United. He was that good, and I think having a player like that in your team in a one-off occasion, you know, and it's going to be his last game as well for Palace, that could turn it for them, you know. So I think you can't write off Palace in this one.
Also, Ian Holloway has got a team up through the playoffs before. I think he might be just a little bit too wily for Zola. And what I think is going to happen is that late doors, Crystal Palace, Zaha will send in a cross which will be converted by a player who suffered playoff final heartbreak 15 years ago.
It's that
Sunderland, when Sunderland got beaten on penalties
by Super Sub himself.
Super Kevin Phillips.
Wow.
Is still playing.
Yeah, of course.
And will almost certainly get a run out for Palace in that playoff final. And he'd been substituted by the time the penalty shootout between Charlton and Sunderland was settled. But it could be, you know, huge redemption for him.
That's crazy, isn't it? It's remarkable that Wembley's going to have two finals in the space of 3 days, both featuring two teams from the same division. Who do you want to go up? Who do you want to go up, Rafa?
I like Gianfranco.
Yeah.
Zola, and I like what are doing. But yeah. Ian Holloway is so fantastically bonkers that I think it'd be a shame not to see his weekly musings on the game and fantastic metaphors like, this win was like picking up a young lady in the middle of the night and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's what I'd like to hear.
I wonder if he does that when he goes out on dates. This date was like a football match.
But he is married.
We've got to coffee. But, well, when he was courting.
Right. Have you ever seen the documentary about him when they were trying to reduce his stress levels? Each day when he got home from work or whatever, he had to, before he went from the front door to the, say, the kitchen to have his dinner or whatever, he had to paint a picture to depict how he was feeling through the medium of art. And this was supposed to calm him down because he was suffered really badly from stress. I think he's improved a lot since. It was a documentary following around at home and at work, and he has I believe three daughters, all of whom are deaf, totally deaf. He'd be storming around the house shouting at them, and they'd be laughing away because he's shouting at them and they can't hear what he's saying. So, you know, what is the point of shouting at us? But, he seemed to have a very colourful family life.
Right.
Highly entertaining.
Oh, you didn't get to see any of his pictures then?
We did get to see them. I can't remember the details. But, if that documentary is out there anywhere, it's just superb TV.
All right. Okay, well, that's coming up on Monday. We will have another chance to reflect on that in Sunday's Champions League final special. Other big news this week, Stoke saying goodbye to Tony Pulis.
Yeah, I suppose they decided it was time for a change. They flirted with relegation this season, ended up finishing 13th in the end and being more than safe. But Pulis, he didn't take out an ad in the Stoke Sentinel, but he did speak to them. And he said, I'm very grateful for this opportunity to express my gratitude because, unlike Robert Mancini in his local paper last week, I can't afford to take out a full-page advert.
Right.
But he went on to thank the fans at the Britannia for their support. And they deserve that, actually, because people are very sniffy, and people who support other teams are very sniffy about Stoke's style of playing, with some justification. But the atmosphere at the Britannia compared to some grounds, and grounds of far more successful teams, is just incredible.
Well, it's regularly recorded as the loudest place in the Premier League.
I know Paul Doyle cited it as, I think, his favourite ground in football.
I was going to say, it's Pulis getting sacked. It's a shame for him, because there's a little less money to spend. He'd probably still be in a job. If you look at they finished 12th, 11th, 13th, 14th and 13th. So that's like, he's been absolutely, you know, kind of spot on in where he's got Stoke season after season. He's the man to bring you mid-table security. But if you want to kick on and get to the next level, he probably isn't, because I think he spent, I think it's only like 75 million net spend.
Figure here is almost 80 million over the past five seasons. Only Chelsea and Manchester City invested more during the same period.
And the signings he's paid for are the ones in 2011. He signed Palacios, Cameron Jerome and Peter Crouch at great expense, and neither of those have lifted their league position any higher than what it was previously.
So he actually didn't need to spend that money?
No.
In football?
And I don't think he knows, you know, I don't think he's the man who knows what to do when he's got a lot of money to spend.
Well, they've now brought in a director of football or whatever the role would be.
I don't think he brought him in last season, I think. I don't think he particularly worked very well alongside Pulis. You know, the high watermark was they got to the FA Cup final in 2011.
Got into Europe as well, didn't
they? And they beat Bolton 5-0 in the semi-final that season, and that's when it looked like Stoke might be about to kick on to the next level, when they had Etherington on the left wing and Pennant on the right wing, and they were playing quite attractive but basic 4-4-2 football, a bit like Blackburn did to win the league, and they had a big man up front in Kevin Jones who could put the, you know, those chances away. And then it went downhill after that, and when he doesn't know what to do, he just goes and buys another battering ram battering stick in the case of Peter Crouch.
I think there could also be, I wouldn't say a problem, but maybe the relationship between him and the players had run its course, because he's a very intense man, a little bit unforgiving. And I think it's only so many years or seasons you can hear the same kind of things and the same kind of pressure. You know, the best coaches or the coaches who last longer, they mix it up a little bit. I don't think he was the man to do that. He had one way, only one way, and he didn't trust anyone else to take training and, you know, in total control of everything. And I think after a while, as the players stopped responding, and even if they'd done better in the table, I think there might have been a chance that they wanted a change.
He ran Stoke as a police state, almost. Just have a moment with that one. Sorry, Greg.
No, I was just going to say, he goes into a season with a survival mentality every year. He's never been relegated. He's never had any team relegated. That's his whole thing, isn't it? But yet, he can't kick on, get out of his own frame of mind.
I mean, just imagine you're sitting in a dressing room again in August, and for the sixth year running or whatever, you hear, we have to survive, this is what you have to do.
Imagine that, Barry, for six or seven years.
Awful.
Same.
Well, during my perusal of the Stoke Sentinel, I read in an interview Ryan Shawcross. Now, I don't know if he's just making the right noises and being diplomatic, but he seemed genuinely gutted that Pulis was leaving.
I met him once, he was a lovely chap.
Ryan Shawcross?
No, actually Tony Pulis.
All right.
I think it could be a real risk sacking him in terms of, we're talking about the money you get next season from the TV revenue in the Premier League, and they'll probably get that anyway, even if they were to get relegated. But I mean, you know, if he's the man to keep you in the Premier League, perhaps keep him there.
Well, if you're looking to push on, you've got a whole bunch of extra cash to spend, then maybe he's not the right. Yeah. I don't know. The likely person to take over.
Maybe the owner just wants a complete change of style, you know.
Sick of messy Tuesday night, kind of wet, windy night, and Stoke jokes and you know, sneery podcasts talking about Stoke style of play.
Yeah. All right. Who's going to take over? What's the word?
Rob Andrew.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
England rugby's
The bookies for some.
My little sneery joke.
The bookies for some.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Right, because of the.
Oh, come on, Jim.
And Martin Johnson. The bookies for some reason seem to believe that Roberto Di Matteo has a chance of getting the job.
Well, there you go.
And Rafa Benitez has been. You think Rafa Benitez is a favourite, isn't he?
No, he's going to Napoli.
Is he going to Napoli?
I hope so.
I think they. Yeah, maybe.
He will probably see Stoke as.
He's also going to Newcastle as well, right?
He's been linked with every club. I mean, to be linked with Stoke and Real Madrid at the same time is some feat, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Certainly is. Well, there you go. That's Tony Pulis. Look forward to seeing him again soon in a new incarnation.
Oh, sorry. One thing. His first game in charge of Stoke was a 4-2 defeat against Walsall.
Really?
Which was covered for The Guardian by a young cub reporter named Sean Ingle.
No way.
Yes, way.
All right, we wanted Sean to join us today, actually.
He had a prior engagement with David Pleat.
Yeah, he's sitting by the phone waiting for David Pleat to call him. We wanted him for the kind of whole Philip Lahmness that he would bring to the pod experience.
Is Sean taking out an ad in the Stoke Sentinel?
He might do. I'd say Shawnee's budget now to be the classifieds.
Anyway, now moving on to posts. Shredded Balls. Oh, he says, did nobody mention that Mike Ashley's generous £1 million win bonus would actually have come from the few million more that Newcastle would have received by climbing the table had they won? Mention is made of the £4 million that Norwich's win at City was worth. I imagine Newcastle would have climbed to a similar position. Then he says, Ashley is a rude word. There you go. It's a shame about that £1 million bonus. So have we had any update on the Tea Ladies Sky subscription?
I haven't heard.
All right. In other post news, Ashman94 says, can there be a Confederation Cup podcast? Please, there can, Ashman, and I suspect there will be one. Yeah, which would be interesting.
I was looking at the lineup for the Confederation Cup.
Spain, Tahiti.
What? It's just cruel letting Tahiti play in that competition. Well, they are going to get slaughtered.
Well, it's a bit like, you know, the Colosseum back in the Roman days, isn't it? Unleash the Lions. I don't know. Maybe it won't be.
They could be very good for all I know. I'm just guessing they're not.
No.
I may have to do some research ahead of this competition.
I imagine they're going to be well organised come that podcast, aren't they?
Yeah, very well. Good at the back.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's interesting. Ali McCoyta says, Confederation Cup is a joke of a tournament that any poor naive bastards like the United States actually think means something. He suggests a money-spinning summer tour where the pod heads off to barnstorm around America, catching MLS games and drinking for free on the tabs of all the desperate for proper football pod listeners in the States.
I'm available for that.
That's an idea, isn't it? Damien Buckley, this is on a Stoke note, says Michael Owen got the lukewarm send-off he deserved at Stoke. We mentioned the fact on Monday that when you compare this to some of the eulogies, etc., and tributes from the fans, etc., it was a bit sad to see him going off that kind of applause at the Britannia. He says he's a player who won't be fondly remembered anywhere. He was only good at Liverpool and he blew that relationship by signing for Man U. Fair, do you think, Greg?
Well, no, not really. I mean, he was very good at Liverpool up until around the age of 22, 23. He was never the same player after he did his hamstring when he was about 19, because he had to change the style of play. He had to bulk himself up a bit. But I don't know. I mean, he's always going to get a lukewarm reception because Stoke were the only club who'd have him, and he hardly played any games for them. So, I mean, had he gone back, I'm sure, you know, there's Liverpool fans who aren't as blinkered, who appreciate what he did when he was very young for the club and the fact that he came through the youth system.
No, fair enough.
What, that Damien Buckley, is that his name?
Damien Buckley 1.
Damien Buckley 1 doesn't know.
Yeah.
Is that Michael Owen and his family took in a duck that had been abandoned and left homeless.
Right.
Nowhere to go.
Right.
Hand-reared that duck, duckling,
into
a nice, fully grown adult lady duck. Mm. The duck left, as ducks tend to do. They move on, pastures new. Anyway, that duck yesterday returned.
No way.
To have, the Owen family were having a short break in Dubai. And while they were away, that duck returned and had her ducklings.
No.
Yeah, in their yard.
No way.
And they returned
to the
site. How
did they know it's
the same duck? What?
Does it have a tag on it or something?
They know. If you live with a duck, you know what it looks like. And anyway, it's that duck, and she now has about 12 or 15 little ducklings.
Wow.
And I would defy
Damien Buckley 1.
Damien Buckley 1. Not to shed a tear at that story.
I can't believe you haven't told us that story before now. What were we waiting for?
It only happened yesterday.
Well, I know.
When did the duck leave? Because if he had a kind of Tony Soprano moment where he felt this kind of withering sadness and existential crisis, it could have affected his career some years ago. And did the duck come back?
Don't ducks bugger off somewhere for the winter and then come back?
Migrate.
Yeah.
I think they do. And it has.
Yeah,
it's an incredible story.
To the Owens' exact backyard where it was hand-reared by these people.
Wow.
So Michael Owen deserves more than lukewarm applause. He deserves a huge ovation.
Off the RSPB, maybe. But
absolutely.
Not necessarily Stoke City fans.
Amazing. An amazing story, Barry.
And if you look on his Twitter feed, you can see a photograph of this
duck
and all her little ducklings.
Mm. Oh,
she had a lot of ducklings.
Cool. Anyway, that's it for part two. Very, very shortly, a bit more. Now, in Italy, there's a big game this weekend as well. only the Coppa Italia, which is a Rome derby. How exciting is that?
Not exciting at all, because you spoke about it on Monday, didn't you?
No, we didn't.
Yes, you did.
We did not talk about it on Monday.
I know that the Coppa Italia is a Rome derby. Yeah. The only conceivable way I would know that is because you mentioned it on Monday.
Well, I might have mentioned that there was a Rome derby, but I didn't say anything else about it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mention, for example, the fact that this is a big security risk because, of course, of late, Rome derbies have become increasingly heated off the pitch, running battles, cars on flames, all that kind of thing. These two sets of fans who have previously united to besiege police stations nearby, assault on Precinct 13 style, were sticking into each other last time. And it was, some extraordinary scenes, you know, smoke billowing around the Stadio Olimpico and that. But so a big security presence is planned for this match, which is of huge importance, not just because it's the Coppa Italia final, but also because they both missed out on Europe. And there's a Europa League place for the lucky winner.
Are they really interested?
I think they are interested, yeah. It's one of the foundations of the project for the new owners at Roma, certainly, Palotta and the Americans, and I think Lazio as well, with Petkovic, they believe that they could have done better this year and they want to have another pop at it in the Europa League.
And is there going to be a 50-50 split in the stadium of fans? Is that why it's more of a concern than ever before? Because normally when they have a home or away game, I suppose, is only, you know...
No, I suppose that's fair. There would be a 50-50.
Yeah, I mean,
it's always a bit of a mess anyway, that game. Injury doubts over Hernanez, the prophet. But Roma come into this with a bit of a headache, managerially speaking, because the word in Italy is that the current man there, Aurelio Andreazzoli, is no longer going to be in charge because they're going to replace him with Massimiliano Allegri, who, as you know, Barry, was on the bench of Milan. But Berlusconi's basically binned him off, even though Galliani, the bloke who looks like Festa, keeps saying, no, we want to keep Allegri. I'm going to have coffee with him and see if we can get him to stay. Berlusconi doesn't like him at all, keeps going on TV saying that he's off, he's not sticking around, he's going to Roma.
Berlusconi, constantly publicly undermine him to the extent that he's once said in front of him, oh, I want to get Pep Guardiola in instead of you.
But in the meantime, he did. He has, all the way through the season as well. And you see, the Milan fans, it's brilliant. The Curva Sud of the San Siro has actually issued its own official comunicato on this, its own statement saying that we believe this is wrong. Also because of who Milan want to replace Allegri. They point out that when you look at how the season started for Milan, they got rid of all the classic, you know, the senators at the club. They sold off Ibra and Thiago Silva. And basically went with a bunch of youth teamers, which worked out pretty well, given that El Shaarawy turned out to be this massive, mini Van Basten. It worked out pretty well, and Allegri did manage to get them into the top three and into the Champions League. But that, given the context they started with, was a huge result, says the Curva Sud, and they don't understand what the point of getting rid of Allegri now is and bringing in the completely untested Clarence Seedorf, who apparently is now set to wing over from Rio de Janeiro and Botafogo to become Milan manager with, excitingly enough, Paolo Maldini as his number two. Paolo Maldini. Woof.
Shouldn't that be the other way around then, really? Is Maldini not the one who would know more about football and he's...
Why, the Clarence Seedorf?
Well, no, I just mean...
Clarence Seedorf's been on the BBC talking about...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
He's
done tactics and stuff.
He be the first black
spent
manager?
Spent hours with Alan Shearer. Hmm. Would he be the first black manager? I think he would.
And how would that go down?
I think he's Clarence Seedorf.
Because he's Clarence Seedorf. He's bulletproof.
I think he'd be fairly bulletproof. But I think, it would be an important step.
Oh, yeah.
For Serie A. I think from some points of view, it's really interesting. But you have to respect the point that the Curva Sud and many others make, which is that Allegri's actually done a pretty good job. And replacing him with somebody who is quite glamorous and sounds like a real novelty but has no zero coaching experience is a real gamble. But there you go.
And talking about gambles, what will Inter do?
Inter have got rid of a young Stramaccioni, and it's not confirmed yet, but it looks like Walter Mazzarri will be turning up on the Inter bench, having confirmed he's not going to be staying at Napoli, where, of course, the excited buzz is that that man, Rafa Benitez, will turn down the pleasures of the Britannia Stadium and join them instead and possibly bring little Fernando Torres with him. How about that?
Can they? They can't pay his wages, surely.
Who? Torres is?
Napoli.
I don't know why not. Probably not. Can they not? Is he on huge wages?
What do you think?
I think he probably is.
He is, yeah.
He is on huge wages. Okay. Can they pay? Well, classically, your Serie A club can't pay huge wages.
Because De Laurentiis is... Yeah. De Laurentiis is a... is a type of owner who wants his club to live within the means, and they've been very smart in buying players. So Torres doesn't really kind of fit into the
philosophy. The only thing about that, and you're absolutely spot on. I mean, financially, there are, I guess, two things. One is the fact that they live within their means, and they're the one of the only few Serie A clubs to make a profit. They should be earning a massive amount of money from the sale of Cavani, although possibly some of that will go on Edin Dzeko bringing him in Cavani's place. We'll have to wait and see about that. The only thing about that, and I'm being a little bit delicate here, but De Laurentiis runs a film company, and it's been pointed out that the reason that they manage to stay officially in profit is the fact that he manages to make all sorts of subcontracts. So there are many different ways of remunerating a player, not all of which pass through the company books. I'm not saying they're illegal. They just maybe will do some promotional work for some of his films. We'll turn
so
up
they're in soaps and lots of films, these
well,
players.
They wouldn't necessarily, although that would be great, wouldn't it? That would be great.
Isn't that a bit like the Spanish story that Sid once told us? Where that, wasn't it Valencia that hired out the players to events and christenings?
Very true, yeah. Anyway, that's a bit of a long shot, I agree. It just has a lovely ring to it, doesn't it? Fernando Torres and Benitez under the shadow of Vesuvius. Or in the shadow. I think you wouldn't be under a shadow. Juve have apparently, say the Italians, signed up a deal to bring Higuain, or however you want to pronounce that.
But haven't they already got Llorente? Why didn't it...
I think they want two of them. They haven't had a proper, you know, a really 20-goal-a-season man for a while. Maybe they think two would be a good idea in the Champions League and all that. Maybe Sid can tell us a little bit more about that in what I think is set to be his final appearance of this season.
Hello.
Gentle, Sid. Gentle.
Sid, I want to know, what are you doing with all your spare time?
I haven't got any spare time at the moment, unfortunately.
Rafa's been everywhere, Sid. Where have you been?
To use the word tied to my desk because I know where you'll go from there. I have been tied to my desk. I'm trying to get this bloody book finished. I'm doing stupid hours at the moment.
What's it about, Sid?
Madrid and Bath.
Are there dragons?
Pretty bad timing, isn't it? It's going to come out just just after they both failed to get to a Champions League final instead of just after they both reach a Champions League final.
Never mind.
Who wants to read about those two when Germany's where it's at these days?
Absolutely. But
Is your book going to be better than Graham Hunter's, which won an award, I think, last night?
Well, it's going to be different, isn't it? Graham's is about Barcelona, just Barcelona. Mine's a history. It's about both clubs.
Double as good.
Double.
Yeah, twice as good. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, on the subject, sorry, of Sid being tied to his desk and fan fiction, I read somewhere today some publishing house is actually going to start publishing fan fiction.
Brilliant.
And selling it in bookshops.
But legally, can you do that?
Apparently so.
No, I find that rather hard to believe, given that it will involve actual real people who would then have
this
say
story
over
was illustrated by a picture of Spock and Captain Kirk engaged in lewd activity.
Wow.
I think you visit websites that I don't know about, Barry.
That was on the Guardian website.
Oh, was it? Bloody hell. Well, you do visit websites I don't know about then.
Yeah. Good. All right. Now, Sid.
Yes.
Bye then, essentially, because this is the...
Enjoy the final. By the way, it's going to be a great final, so enjoy it.
Yeah, okay, good. Any transfer stuff we should know? We were just talking about Neymar and Higuain and that kind of thing. Any developments we should know?
Isco, Pellegrini, Iago Aspas, Soldado, Negredo. I think it's going to be really quite a mad summer because there's been so many changes of coach. That, of course, brings with it changes of players. I think we're going to see a really, really busy summer. And I hate to say it, but I think we'll see another summer that undermines the Spanish league still further.
Oh, that's a shame. Why? Because there's so many people are going to leave.
The good players from the clubs that aren't the big two will leave. They'll have, as they always do, the very best players in Spain will have a choice. One of the big two, who can only put so many people in their squad, or go abroad. And I think we'll see quite a lot of them go abroad.
Is there going to be a lot of new Michus, are there?
There isn't an obvious Michu candidate this year as there was last year, because, I mean, Michu was a relatively obvious candidate, although should have cost more than $2 million. But there's plenty of good players around. Aspas, for example, is someone who hasn't been talked about very much, but I think he's a very good player, and there seems to be some interest from him.
Where's he from?
He's at Celta de Vigo at the moment. He got banned for 4 games after headbutting someone in the Galician derby, and he's a little bit hot-headed, to say the least, but he's a very, very talented player. And it would only cost $10 million to get him, so I think there's a reasonably good signing there for an English club.
Sid, I'm interested to get your view on the reception of the German final. Not so much on the sporting level, because I think the two teams played football that was appreciated in Spain, but more maybe the political dimension. I think here in the UK it's not really an issue because Germany, England, not really, there's not a lot of tension, but of course there is a lot of tension when it comes to Spain and Germany with the political situation in the Euro. So has that played a role in the way this final is seen, and has it sort of dampened the euphoria for all things Bundesliga, or what's happening?
No, I think what it's actually done is it's almost increased the euphoria for the two German sides, because there's been a sense of looking at these two as a model of the things that we should be doing in Spain and we're not doing in Spain. They look at the way that German clubs are run, and of course it's partly through, you know, it's partly kind of an idealized vision of what Germany are doing, and say, well, and look at the shambles of Spanish clubs, because Spanish football at organizational level really is a massive, massive shambles. There was an interesting comment from Javier Tebas, who's the president of the league, used to be the vice president, and he was asked if he was jealous of the Bundesliga, and he kind of wrapped it up quite nicely by saying, well, I'm jealous of their 6% unemployment, 26% I think it is in Spain, and over, I think it's over 50% in the under 25s. I mean, you know, it's astonishing figures, really. And so there is a sense of this being a product of something bigger. There's a little bit of tension in that sense of, well, you know, Spain are partly struggling because of the repayments that are forced upon Spain by Germany, but that's not really seen as a German imposition so much as a Spanish failure. So it hasn't turned that way yet. But there's small elements of it, of course.
Right, no one expects the German imposition, of course. Was there anything else we should be looking out for? I mean, we mentioned the Neymar thing.
Yeah, the Neymar thing. To be honest, I'm bored of it. I think it's very likely that he'll go to Barcelona.
Right.
I don't know exactly when. They're getting quite upset on the other side of Barcelona, because yesterday, to promote the new Barcelona shirt, they put it on the big statue of Columbus in Barcelona, pointing out to the sea. So, of course, Columbus is now a Barcelona fan. And the president of Espanyol, Joan Collet, who seems to spend all of his life getting upset about things, said this is the last straw. The last straw what? Because a multinational sticks a shirt on a statue for a couple of hours.
Why is Columbus, sorry about this, why is Columbus in Barcelona? They're not claiming he set off from there, are they?
Well, there's a big, great big Columbus statue that points out to sea at the bottom of the Ramblas. Are they claiming he's from there? You know what? You've caught me. I have no idea where Columbus set sail from.
Well, he sets out from Genoa traditionally, but then again, Seville, they talk a lot about his ship sailing
from
there.
Yeah, and Spanish, and of course he set sail on behalf of Ferdinand and Isabella, who was Spanish monarchs at the time. You know, there can be a statue of him without him necessarily having claimed, or them having necessarily claimed on his behalf that he set sail from Barcelona. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I'm going to go and look it up right now.
He was like a hired gun.
Yeah, but I still don't see why
for
Barcelona.
The Spanish.
He certainly wasn't sailing from there.
No, there's a big one. There's a big one in Madrid
but,
as
but
well.
But why not? Because there's still the idea of, you know, this is a guy that discovered the Americas for us, so here he's pointing at the sea from Spain's probably most important port.
Can I ask a question, actually, at this point? Etymologically speaking, does the word colonised come from Christopher Columbus?
Good question.
Because his name in Spanish is Cristobal Colón.
Spanish. No? Yeah, and it's presumably Colón in, or Colono in, what is it in Italian? Colón or Colono? Or
no, they just call him Cristobal Colón.
Right, same as in Spanish. Yeah, maybe it's colonized.
So you could basically say the president of Espanol is suffering from colonic irritation.
I tell you.
And
what?
On that note, I plan never to crack a joke ever again.
Oh.
That cannot be surpassed.
There you go, Barry. Barry wins the podcast. Super. But Sid, that's magnificent then. We'll let you get on with your book. And that, and when's it going to be out?
In theory, in September.
Good, 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 good. Yeah. And maybe we'll speak to you before that, because we're going to be covering, in all its intensity, the Confederations Cup. You can maybe...
Oh, that'd be quite good fun.
You can preview Spain-Tahiti for us.
When I was a kid, right, we used to do goals tapes, which basically meant recording bits off St. and Greavesy and off Football Focus. And there's a line that still sticks in my head, which I think is from the 78 World Cup, when someone scores and the commentator shouts out, and it's Mr. Football from Tahiti. So hopefully he'll be playing this time around as well.
There's your headline. Super stuff. Sid, have a super summer in the meantime. And many, many thanks for all your entertaining interventions this season. And good luck with the typing.
Are you going to publish a book, by the way, of all the doodles you've done while I've been talking
this
year? That's
a great shout. We could give the money to charity, couldn't we?
I don't have money.
Or to a duck sanctuary somewhere.
Yeah.
Super. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, with that, we're almost at the end of today's show. It's not the final show of the season because, on Sunday we're back, Rafa.
With another Rome Derby preview.
Yeah. Highs and lows of the season, Barry. Come on, it's the final podcast.
Well, I was just looking through the poll our readers voted on their best and worst of the season, and I just found it interesting that of all the things supporters could complain about, ticket prices, TV scheduling, blah, 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 the thing the majority of our readers found the most irritating about the Premier League all season was that little heart shape that Gareth Bale makes
You're
with
joking.
His hands after scoring a goal.
I don't get that at all. Yeah, it's not... But there's so many things he could do. You know, he's sending a message of love. We need more of that in the world.
Yeah,
Greg?
Hi. Do you remember Van Persie's goal in the FA Cup he scored against West Ham? It was a long ball played over to him 50 yards, and it was right. just his first... I've never seen a first touch as good with his left foot. His wrong foot, he took one touch, and then he scored a great goal, and that was the best goal of the season. But that was, yeah, that's a high for me.
All right.
And a low, like, the ticket prices, everyone goes on about ticket prices, and they are disgraceful, and the FSF and other various club supporters groups, fan supporters groups are doing a lot to challenge them. But I think not taking banners into the ground and paying money to go and watch these matches and then protest in the ground in which you paid 55, 60 quid to enter. I mean, like, surely now there's time to think about boycotting one Premier League weekend or something next season.
It's really interesting. You know, idea. Just everybody boycotts.
Yeah, and
weekend.
I know you've got season ticket holders who have already paid up or whatever, but make a stand and don't go into the ground, because until you start doing that, I don't think there's going to be any shift from the Premier League and from the clubs on ticket prices.
It's a very interesting point. There's been so much incident and so much of it towards the tail end of the season, it seems. It's hard to look back to... Probably there was some amazing stuff back in August, September. Mm. All I can think of is Suarez's bite, which was just ludicrous. The Dortmund-Malaga game, which was...
Just ludicrous.
Just ludicrous. Mm-hmm. Klopp's post-game interview.
Just ludicrous.
All those playoff games, like the Doncaster one and the Watford one. They were crazy as well. I love a bit of right at the death Hail Mary stuff.
Did Matteo sacking at Chelsea, that was a bit crazy, wasn't it? And then the whole reception for Rafa, that was last season.
The whole Rafa thing.
In the last year. Yeah, that was...
Punching a horse, that was quite strange.
Yeah, Michael Owen wouldn't like that.
No, absolutely not. In terms of the football and the battle for the title in the Premier League, it wasn't the most overwhelming of campaigns, but did seem to be throwing up a new story every day. I thought it was quite an entertaining time.
It was entertaining, it always is entertaining.
Good.
But sometimes it gets a bit tedious, and I think... We should all enjoy the little break we have.
All right, then.
And, come back refreshed and invigorated for more of the same old crap next season.
Right.
But can you honestly believe that there won't be Alex Ferguson in the Premier League next season? Still haven't quite grasped the...
And yet the Premier League will rumble on just fine without him.
I know what you're saying, Rafa.
There's like United fans who are 27 years old who have never known their club to have another manager, and now they're like supporting a normal team like the rest of us have to, you know. It's quite interesting to see how they take that, because a lot of them, you know, have got a lot to say on the internet whilst Ferguson has been there. Let's see what they've got to say when he's not there.
Crikey.
And also, can the internet be switched off for the summer when the season ends and maybe switch back on again?
Why would you want to do that? Surely we need it now more than ever.
The internet's just horrible. Hasn't the internet just ruined society? It wouldn't be better without it. I know you could listen to this podcast and you can listen to things.
No, I think internet would be better without society rather than the other way.
Do you think so? Oh, okay, now fair enough.
Save all this prediction stuff for the appropriate time, which is, of course, during our Confederations podcast. So look forward to seeing you for that midway through June. Rafa, of course, we're going to be together on Sunday afternoon.
Look forward to it.
Tranny's press to our ear, if you'll excuse the expression, for the Coppa Italia final, of course. And have a super time until then. There is a special pay-per-view up on Friday morning, or possibly before. So hopefully you'll log on to that. But in the meantime, many thanks for listening. Many thanks to guest producer Ian, to Greg Bukowski, to Barry Glendinning and Raphael Honigstein. And we'll speak to you soon.